Chapter 33 Lady Pentandra of Fairogs.
I really don't want you to go,
Alia sighed in resignation. I seem to be saying that an awful lot lately. I don't particularly want to go, I agreed as I packed, but I really don't have much choice.
I know.
I thought I was marrying a spellmonger. Now I'm a lady of the domain, and I have to run this place while you're gone.
Responsibilities,
she agreed quietly. At least I can stay in touch with the mirror, she added. She had been delighted when Bannermore demonstrated how the device worked to her a week ago, contacting the captain of the guards at the Dyke Tower to prove its efficacy.
That's some consolation. You know, I envy all those magi who can speak to you with a thought.
I figured it would be impolitic to point out that a man whose wife can reach him with a thought might soon contemplate suicide. And kissed her instead. Don't. The conversations we have are usually about politics or war, not the sorts of things I want to discuss with my wife. This shouldn't be a hard time. I'll only be gone a couple of weeks, and you'll have plenty to occupy yourself. It's almost harvest time. We need to prepare for winter, and there's an awful lot of work to be done. The castle, the domain, the magical fair. The time will pass before you know it, I soothed.
I know, she sighed. I just wish you wouldn't leave me, or that I was going.
I'd rather have you in Sevendor, where I know you're safe. Sir Kay is here, as are Sir Ferrando, Sir Roncel, and the other knights. Even Sir Fess, I pointed out. Sir Festeran had become a favourite at Sevendor Castle, and got along famously with Lady Estret. It turned out they have a few cousins in common, through House Lensley's long legacy in the region. They brought a sense of Rivelin's propriety to the castle, amidst the rough manners and casual attitude of most of my Bovali.
It's not my safety that concerns me, she said, troubled. It's yours. I know the censorate has put a price on your head, and you've told me that the ducal courts are full of backstabbing, both literal and figurative, so
I've been through two wars and a lot of battles, and I'm not dead yet, I pointed out, kissing her again. Trust me, I'll have Rondal and Tyndall around, as well as every high war magi who can be spared from the front. Castabriel is the last place the censorate would try to capture me. I'll be plenty protected.
You had just better come back to me alive,
she demanded, kissing me back. That conversation haunted me all the way downriver, on the majestic barge Penny had chartered for us for transport. Alia was not a fainting flower of femininity. She was a hardy country lass. While she was far out of her element, and doing the best she could under the circumstances, I had every confidence that she could handle anything in my absence short of the dead god showing up with a castle-warming gift. She hated to complain or whine, except to me, and took all that the gods had thrown at her with a tremendous amount of grace. But I couldn't expect her to have the stoicism of a noble woman who was used to having her husband gone for months, not just weeks at a time. And the truth was, I was heading into danger, no matter how much I demurred to my wife. If not a war or battle, the intrigues of court were just as dangerous and potentially deadly as facing down a legion of goblins. Penny had been trying to prepare me, explaining the ducal courts I had attended in the summer palaces of Wilderhall and Verone were almost informal affairs compared to a full coronet council and the first coronation of a sitting monarch in 400 years. I shouldn't have been nervous about leaving her and Sevendor behind. Everything I said was true. While I was robbing her of the Knights Magi who could help defend my domain, I was leaving her with a far more defensible castle, a barracks full of well-trained militia, at least 2 or 3 lances of knighthood, and both Olmeg and Bannermore were staying behind. We had an official treaty with our only local enemy, and I was only going to be gone about 3 weeks. What could happen? I spent most of the river journey quietly imagining just what could happen until Taran, who had joined us halfway through our voyage, along with a handful of other high magi returning from various errands at my direction, pointed out that I was shooting sparks, magical slang for a pointless and impotent endeavor. He got me drunk that night, and for the next several days I didn't worry about Alia, Sevendor, or anything but the task at hand, getting a crown on Rard's head. That was essential, for me personally and professionally. Without King Rard to give us political cover, there was no higher authority that the censorate could be forced to answer to.
Failing to crown Rad would put the censorate at open war with the High Magi, when we already had one war to contend with. As much as it seemed a waste of time and resources when there was invasion imminent in Gilmora, I was taking my entourage to Castabriel to ensure our political survival. Penny's new estate, and the unofficial temporary embassy of the Arcane Orders, was half a day's ride, or 3 hours' worth of floating, upriver from the city, which meant we arrived there before we got to the capital. Fair Oaks didn't have its own river port, but she had heavily bribed the docksmen of the village nearest to her estate to make certain we were properly greeted, our baggage handled, and we were escorted to the carriages and wains she had arranged to transport us. I saw immediately how she had bribed them, too. A large length of freshly enchanted stone jutted from the riverbank in such a way as to shield the village from floodwaters, and the dock we tied up to was enchanted to never decompose. Penny's estate was elegant enough to make Seven Doors seem rustic. It was a fortified manor, not a castle, a large circular structure, 4 stories tall, and sprawling wings and outbuildings in every direction. It was very pretty, as she promised, and the entranceway was grand. Some burgher or lord spent a lot of gold to make it that way, I knew.
"Gods," whispered Tyndall, as our carriage arrived at the archway leading in. "Lady Pentandra sure has a definite sense of style."
"She likes pretty things," I shrugged. "This is the first home she's ever had on her own."
"It suits her,"
I admitted, as the sound of the carriage wheels changed as we drove from dirt to cobble. "I expect both of you to be on your best behavior. Remember, you are my apprentices, my liegemen, and my bodyguards. Don't screw up and get me killed."
"Master, we would never take that pleasure away from you,"
Rundahl said saucily. I made a face. They were excited, and it was hard to blame them. They were a couple of boisterous boys, but my apprentices knew enough to keep their mouths shut when we weren't alone. "I'm serious. This is going to be as dangerous as a war. There are plenty of people who would like to see me dead who don't wear checkered cloaks. I won't be able to look everywhere at once, so I'll need you two to watch my back constantly. Mage blades at all times. At least 2 war wands in your belt. Understand?"
"Understood,"
they said in unison. They knew how important this was. I had lectured them on it virtually the whole voyage, when I wasn't imagining all the horrible things that could happen to my domain, my wife, and my son in my absence. I just hoped the couple of up-jumped, backwards apprentice spellmongers from the Wilderlands would not embarrass our order at the first royal court in living memory. When the carriage stopped, a liveried footman opened the door and presented us with a little stool to descend upon. I was startled when a trumpet fanfare blared when my foot touched it. "Announcing Sire Minelin, the spellmonger, Mage Lord of Sevendor," bellowed someone who was obviously paid for his ability to bellow.
"What the hell's?"
I asked, looking around confusedly. There was a whole party of liveried servants in formation, including some foreboding-looking guards in full armor, and 2 war magi, whose names I forgot, standing by, dressed in the tabards of their respective orders, ceremonial staves in hand. Hawken and Hessian, I saw.
"Just thought I'd get you used to being properly announced,"
Penny said, separating herself from the crowd and kissing me lightly on the cheek. Wrapped in a gown of red, pink, and gold, she looked every bit the Ramiran lady of leisure enjoying her country estate. She spared a glance at Rundahl and a longer one at Tyndall.
"Come, I have refreshments waiting. There is a lot to discuss, and we don't have much time. You two,"
she said, indicating my boys,
"you help see your master's baggage is properly stowed. Miji, here, will show you to his quarters. Yours are the room next to it,"
she added.
"We're pretty full, but I saved one of the better guest rooms for you, Min,"
she smiled. "What do you mean we don't have much time? I'm 2 days early and the council doesn't start for 4 days.
"And that means we have very little time,"
she agreed.
"We have to go over the final version of our charters, review the war situation, examine which political players are our enemies, our friends, or both, all that sort of thing. Oh, and I have a special present for you, Min. Something you specifically asked for, if you recall."
She snapped her fingers,
and a young woman stood forward with a long box made of a light, pretty-looking wood. Pentandra opened it and stood back to watch my expression. It was a hat. Not just a hat, but a wizard's hat, the traditional four-pointed cap associated with my profession since antiquity. Usually the central peak is surrounded by the other three smaller points, in an equilateral triangle, and sewn or buttoned or pinned to the main cone. I had a couple of these myself, one from my graduation from Inarion, and one from my spellmongering days. But this one was special. It was at least 18 inches tall, from brim to peak. The main cone was a deep blue colour, while the additional flaps, they were purely decorative, not true points in their own right, were yellow, green, and red. Various mystical symbols and arcane formulae were embroidered into the blue in golden thread, and the brim was actually a metal circlet, more suited to a war helm than a mage's hat. A small gold tassel was suspended from every point. It was the silliest god's damned hat I'd ever seen. "Oh, goddess," I whispered. "You do recall insisting on wearing a funny hat. This was as funny as I could make it without impugning your dignity."
"I'm not sure you were successful," I remarked quietly.
"Luckily, you don't have a lot of dignity," she continued with a straight face. "The design is based loosely on the late Magocracy's official headgear for the Archmage."
"I'm not an Archmage," I pointed out.
"Which is why this is just loosely based on it," she continued. "The Eastern Duchies get touchy about that sort of thing. If I copied it exactly, they would see it as a slight or a declaration of political purpose. As it is, I blended elements of the Archmagi's hat and the traditional spellmonger's cap in a way that some folks would see as scandalous."
"People get that worked up about a hat."
She rolled her eyes. "You haven't read much ancient history, have you? There have been at least 2 wars started over hats. No, I'm serious. But this one should be grand enough for court, and we can giggle about it later. Oh, and I took the liberty of adding a few special enchantments myself. We'll cover them later."
I had to try it on, and the reflective surface I conjured allowed me to see just how silly I looked in the multicoloured monstrosity. I saw several servants suppress giggles. Tyndall uttered a guffaw when he returned from stowing the baggage. I was tempted myself. It looked damn silly. Penny took me on a whirlwind tour of her busy estate, showing off her parlour, her magnificent dining hall, her well-panelled great hall, now hung with beautiful Remeran tapestries, and her lab. I was especially interested in the last, as Penny is one of the best thaumaturges I know. It was impressive, but mostly unused, she explained, because she had been so busy with everything else that was now her responsibility. Politics. Over lunch on her west patio, the spires of the capital just barely visible over the trees, she filled me in on who had arrived and who we were still waiting upon. "Most of the Hessian Order is here already," she explained. "In fact, they set up a 6 pavilions on my commons out back to house the overflow. The Hawkins are mostly still en route, those who weren't stuck at the front. Tellerman will be here late, of course, and he'll leave early, but he'll stay for long enough to see the coronation and swear his oath. The medical and thaumaturgical orders will be well represented, too. All told, we should have almost 50 High Magi here. Maybe more." She paused and considered. "You know, that's probably the biggest and most powerful gathering of Magi since the Empire fell." "If not long before," I pointed out. "Probably the most since Perwin sank. Still, every shard of Irionite we have put together wouldn't put us in the same class as Sherul."
"It's not his arcane powers that are worrying people here," she reported. "It's the legions he has invading Gilmora. It's one thing when a goblin invasion is happening way off in the Alshari Wilderlands. Once it gets to the Castali Riverlands, every lord in Gilmora has been screaming at Ra'ad for help."
"And we're that help?"
"Part of it. Tellerman has been a very visible sign of support in Gilmora, organizing local defenses and deploying war magi to shore up castles and bridges. He's kept a good order on our people, and compared to the mercenaries who have signed on, the arcane orders have been some of Duke Ra'ad's best public relations. Enough that I don't see much resistance coming from Gilmora. And from what Tellerman has told me,
The goblins there now are more skirmishers than heavy troops. They are raiding villages, not besieging castles.
I know, I sighed. I got better reports than she did. The shamans have been decidedly country bumpkin witch doctors. The Urgulnosti priests are probably with the main invasion force, and they're battling down the lumber road. That's when things are going to get hairy, I said grimly.
Let's forget about the big ugly goblin for a while, shall we? She asked sweetly. We have more pressing dangers. For example, the Duke of Merwin, it is rumoured, holds us responsible for both the death of his brother Duke Lenguin and the goblin threat. Not that he was remotely close to Lenguin, but he apparently sees the best chance for us is to go back to the old way, suppress magic, and deal with the goblins in purely military terms.
Well, sure he does, I exploded. He's got 3 duchies between him and the dead god's hordes.
Well, all of the anti-Halterian censors are cozying up to him, looking to him for support. He brought several in his entourage, checkered cloaks and all, as part of his embassy. It is rumoured that the senior surviving members are electing a new censor general and moving his command to Merwin.
Let them, I dismissed. As long as they stay on that side of the frontier, we won't have any problems.
Oh, but we do, she corrected.
The Merwini and Vorian commanders have secretly authorized specific loyal war magi to be issued their own witch stones from inventory, to be used against us, she added pointedly,
and I don't like the sound of that at all.
It was inevitable, I dismissed. There have to be some witch stones they've confiscated over the years left in their vaults, and after the way I outclassed 5 of their best at the fair, they're unlikely to proceed against me again without one.
Exactly. So watch your back.
The coronet truce will hold for the Duke of Merwin's actual party, but the old guard censors don't feel bound by a mere ducal decree, and they don't want to see a king on a throne either. It's not the king they should be concerned with. It's his wife.
Oh, I know all about Mother, she snickered.
I've already had a few encounters with her.
In my professional opinion, she's a first-class cunt.
I inadvertently choked and sprayed wine, really good wine, all over her lovely white tablecloth. I hadn't expected that particular word to fall out of her mouth, but I couldn't honestly disagree.
But that doesn't mean we can't work with her, at least for now, Penny said smoothly,
dabbing the wine away with her napkin.
We don't have to like her. Her intelligence assets are impressive, though, she admitted, but she's not the only player in town. We have already been subtly approached by both the Brotherhood and the Iris.
The Brotherhood of the Rat was a criminal organization centered on the docks and ports of Rhymir, Castile, and Alshar. The Iris was similar, only they were much older, much bigger, and far more spread out. So what did you tell them?
That we'd consider an alliance once things settled down. That's all they were looking for, really, to see if we could be of use to them, or they to us. The Brotherhood was a little more threatening and a little more accommodating, while the Iris was more distant and formal, but less eager for an entanglement.
The Rats are still pissed over getting blamed for the Duchess' assassination, I pointed out. If they think we're on the outs with the family, they might see us as a natural ally. What did you tell them?
Essentially that we'd be willing to listen, but only after a successful coronation. I gathered that neither party was thrilled with the prospect, but I managed to point out several advantages of a change in politics, and neither seems hell's-bent on stopping it.
That's good to know. Anything else?
Why, yes, Master, she said with a straight face. I have also been approached by Sire Relvanian of Teratine.
And I should be familiar with the gentleman. Why?
He's the unofficial representative of a group of barons who are decidedly against the establishment of a kingdom, and who see treachery in how the last Duke of Alshar died.
Well, I can't deny the treachery, but you can't bring Lenguin back to life either. He wasn't much use when he was alive, if they recall.
That's what they're afraid of, that a kingdom would attempt to usurp their powers in their own domains. Most of them are coastal lords or southern river lords, and they've been ruling their domains virtually independent of ducal authority for a century now. Ironic that they invoked the duke they cursed for an ineffective fool last year as a martyr for their rebellion this year, she chuckled.
As I get used to this whole nobility act,
I'm starting to see how such things happen, I admitted. What exactly do they hope to accomplish? Absent the rhetoric about usurpation of sovereignty and illegal impingement on traditional rights, they don't want to be subject to the new kingdom-wide tax and tribute scheme. They think they can successfully break away, and they're considering it. There's a charismatic count in the coastlands who is preparing a full-fledged rebellion. Is there even going to be a new kingdom-wide tax and tribute scheme? I asked, confused. Penny looked at me like I was the village dummy, and then used that same level of condescending patience to lecture me. Of course there's going to be a new tax and tribute scheme. The new kingdom needs a new administrative infrastructure, and someone has to pay for that. The war effort needs funding in a permanent way. There are plenty of excellent reasons why the kingdom will need new taxes and a new tribute scheme. Believe me, I've spoken with the poor bastards who are trying to come up with it, and it isn't going to be pleasant, particularly on the great lords. Come spring, everyone with the rank of baron and above is going to be swearing bitterly to the gods. They'll swear more under the sacrificial knife, I warned. Such bickering made me angry. I haven't mentioned the nearly constant reports of goblins marching long strings of captured human prisoners back into the Umbra, never to be seen again, because honestly, it was just too depressing. That's essentially what I told them, but they think they can hold out. Worse, they feel they can encourage the Farisi to rebel too. Not that Rad can't put down a rebellion, but it would be expensive. That's the last thing we need, I spat. Every sword we send to put down rebellion is one less to fight the dead god. Hey, I wrote that song you're singing, she reminded me. So I had a unique solution in mind, she said. Then she closed her eyes for a moment, and I could feel a spell drop on us. There. Now no one can hear us. Then she told me her plan, and I had to admit it was pretty bloody brilliant. There are going to be an awful lot of lords unhappy with that arrangement, I said when she was done. They'll be more unhappy if the dead god is in charge. Honestly, Min, can you think of any other way to get the manpower we need for this war? No, I agreed, and that solves plenty of other problems, and raises yet more. Have you considered writing up a charter? That sort of thing would have to be a royal decree, I foretold. Anything less would lead to widespread rebellion. I thought you might say that, she smirked, and reached under the table to retrieve a big sheaf of parchment, which is why I took the liberty of having it pre-written for His Majesty's seal. We can sneak it in with the charters for all of the other orders we're chartering. I can't imagine he'd object. Really, it's as much for his benefit as it is for ours.
I'm so glad you see it that way, Min, she smiled sweetly, because you're the one who has to convince him of that.
It was a good working lunch, but I was painfully aware that neither of us brought up the subject of Isili's child, who was likely mine, that Penny knew about, but about whom I was supposed to be ignorant. I almost brought it up myself, half a dozen times, but in the end I always thought better of it. There was just too much going on, and that kind of thing had the potential to make everything else we were doing a lot more complicated. Call me a coward if you wish, but I prefer to choose the time, place, and disposition of my battles before I fight them. I'm not a coward, but I'm lazy as anyone. I just didn't have the emotional capacity to contend with the subject. The next couple of days were filled with meetings and discussions as we prepared for the council. New High Magi were wandering in all the time, and I had to stop and chat with them repeatedly, thank them for their attendance, and in some cases received reports. The second day, Penny's estate at Fair Oak saw the arrival of 20 mounted knights magi, directly from the front in Gilmora. They were led by Talaman, and after we warmly embraced and went inside, he started chewing me out almost at once. "Don't strike me if I exaggerate, but we're getting routed out there," he admitted. "We're doing plenty of damage. Anywhere I send a mage, they make a big difference. But we aren't stopping them at all. Hells, we're barely slowing them down. Every time we destroy a band or a raiding party, there seems to be two more, and finding men willing to stand and fight is getting harder. The Day of the Dragons was brutal," he confessed. "We've had a devil of a time getting troops since dragons got involved in the war." I assured him the best I could that help was on the way, and it was, but that we had to get through this first. Surprisingly, he didn't argue. I could use a few days away from the front, and I'd be happy to swear my fealty to a king instead of a duke.
I really don't see much difference, I observed.
There's not, on the surface, but I think it gives the men a psychological edge to be under a king, not just a high noble.
They'll die the same way, whichever one is in charge.
Chalaman brought more than complaints from the battlefield, though. He presented me with 4 more witchstones captured from goblin shamans, ready to be cleansed and distributed to worthy magi. As Fair Oaks began to fill up in earnest, I made a point to be seen frequently in my new silly-looking hat, staff in hand, congratulating and encouraging all the magi who now looked to me for leadership. Some looked battle-scarred, and others found their new roles as mage lords or knights magi to suit them. One of my fellows, the nominal court wizard of Alshar, brought some intriguing news. Master Dunsellan would be arriving late, because he was at war.
Honestly, I didn't think the old bird had it in him, Master Thinraddle told me at supper that evening. You remember that old estate he prattled on about? Well, once he returned and claimed it, his neighbours took offence. He used his stone to level their castles and took their lands in conquest. He's running 3 domains now, and about to finish conquering a 4th.
Master Dunsellan? That old... I didn't know exactly how to finish that sentence, so I didn't.
The very one. He even goes into battle, so to speak. He rides in a carriage behind his lances, and when there's an engagement he rains down spellfire on them, or puts sentries to sleep, or some such, just like a war mage. He was always quite powerful, even before he had Irionite, but I had always considered him harmless.
Power does strange things to some people, I observed. Thinraddle nodded sagely. One of the only other interesting things that happened in the days leading up to the Arcane Order's departing Fair Oaks for the capital was meeting up with Master Cormoran, the enchanter who built my mage blade, and hundreds of others. I'd seen him at Robin Wing Castle, of course, but we hadn't much time for discussion. He insisted on seeing me the moment he got to Fair Oaks, however, and I owed the man so much, I stepped out of a meeting to speak with him. He asked that we find a quiet place, and I led him to Penny's study. There we sat, with a table between us, where he poured out a bag of familiar white pebbles.
That snowstone you created, I've been testing it. A lot of people have been testing it, actually. But your initial assessment, while helpful, was wrong.
What do you mean?
Snowstone doesn't increase a particular mage's powers. It works the other way, reducing his body's resistance to magic. It has essentially the same effect.
I nodded. The way I understood talent, you had a specific amount and type, usually fixed at a particular level.
That agrees with the tests I've made as well, I agreed. Oh, it gets better, he grinned. Everyone and everything has some resistance to magical forces. One pebble of this, and that resistance almost evaporates. Honestly, I've never seen anything like it. I've used it while enchanting mage blades, and the results have been impressive.
That was high praise from Cormoran.
If you're sitting on a mountain of this stuff, you're a rich man, Master Minelin. I'd like to get as much as I can to fortify my castle. Lance of Boon raved about it, and there are enchanters everywhere who would prize it almost as much as they would Irionite.
Wait, you have a castle?
In the Mage Lands, he explained, just outside the Penumbra. A big one, too, a baronial castle. It used to be called Meadowmont, but I've renamed it Forgemont. I never thought I'd go in for the life of a mage lord, but I have to admit being free to do experiments with Irionite and steel and spells without having to worry about the censorate makes all the petty administrative issues almost worthwhile.
Just wait, I sighed, realizing that for all the impressive improvement I'd effected in Sevendor, I had done virtually no magical research myself. I was just too damned busy.
Someday, someone will come along and make you important, and you won't have any fun anymore.